is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
It's the greatest dream I've ever dreamt. And when we got to stand there, and again, it wasn't about me, it was about those players and their commitment, but just to get to be a part of it. And when you hear that anthem, they got the gold medals around their necks, I can't even start to put into words. It was the greatest honor of my life, outside of being the father to my children and the husband to my wife. There's really nothing else like that.
Nick LaGalbo is entering his 14th season as the head boys basketball coach at his alma mater, Lane Tech High School in Chicago, Illinois. Nick recently returned from Hungary, where he led the Team USA U18 men's and women's teams to gold medals in the FIBA 3-on-3 World Cup. Nick has worked with USA Basketball as a lead clinician for their youth development clinics and regional camps. He serves as a regional coordinator for USA Basketball 3-on-3, and he has also spoken at USA Basketball's Coaches Academy to other aspiring coaches from across the country. Nick played his high school basketball at Lane Tech and then played 4 years of collegiate basketball at Benedictine University. He's been working at Lane Tech since graduating from college as an English teacher, basketball coach, and he now also serves as the school's athletic director.
If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the HoopHeads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The HoopHeads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at HoopHeadsPod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@HoopHeadsPod.com. Follow us on social media at HoopHeadsPod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the HoopHeads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Hey, HoopHeads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Sign up now for their virtual camp 2.0 featuring 10 days of workouts with pro trainers from the Dr. Dish family. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the HoopHeads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, HoopHeads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Jonathan Sippis, and you're listening to the HoopHeads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Be prepared with a notebook and pen as you listen to this episode with gold medal winning coach Nick LaGalbo from Lane Tech High School in Chicago, Illinois.
Hello and welcome to the HoopHeads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome back to the podcast now, not only as a basketball coach and a guest, but a friend, Nick LaGalbo from Lane Tech High School in Chicago, recent gold medal winning coach with the USA Basketball men's and women's U18 3-on-3 teams. Nick, welcome back, man.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me, guys. Really excited to be on and catch up. And like you said, now we put a face to the name, and we've got a blossoming friendship here, you know, Snow Valley. So, yeah, man, excited to be back on.
Yeah, no question about that. It's one of the most gratifying parts of the podcast is just having an opportunity to build relationships with great people and get a chance to develop an honest friendship and develop something that, again, is not just about what we do here on the podcast, but being able to get to know one another outside of that. And it's been a lot of fun
working with you on a couple different projects and then getting a chance to actually connect in person twice. And like I said, feeling like we're developing a true and honest friendship, which is what it's really all about when it comes down to it. So let's jump right into your gold medal winning experiences with USA Basketball and the 3-on-3 under 18 teams. And maybe let's start, before we dive into the actual experience when you went over to Hungary, just give people a quick refresher on the story of how you got connected to USA Basketball in the beginning, and then that can kind of lead us into how you ended up with this opportunity to coach the 3-on-3.
Yeah. So again, I'm still, I mean, you just talked about it and I'm just smiling ear to ear because obviously just the experience of a lifetime. And, you know, I talk about all the time with my players and, you know, my students and people I work with, but you know, you never know who's in a room who could directly change the trajectory of your life. And, you know, for me, it's my mentor and, you know, now a great friend, but a true mentor, Coach Don Showalter. And, you know, I just think like most of us, for me, years ago when he first, I mean, he was coaching, obviously he's a Hall of Fame coach in the state of Iowa and very successful, but you know, when he first got on the scene with USA, when he started coaching the junior national team, he spoke at some Nike clinics. And, you know, I'll never forget it. I was kind of at a time in my life where I was newly married, you know, wanted to start a family, young coach. And, you know, I just kind of had some people in my life that, I don't know if they just had their own perspective on it. But a lot of people were telling me, you know, being a family man and being a coach didn't really mix. And, you know, you're never home for your kids and you got to make a decision. And I just didn't buy that. And it started me really, you know, get me down a path of like, is this really what I want to do? Because if I want to be a successful coach, I mean, not just wins and losses, but really impacting lives. Like, am I going to be able to juggle family and everything? And I don't know, man, I'll never forget. I saw Coach Show. And, you know, I think a lot of times when you go to these Nike clinics and you're a young coach, and you guys probably can relate, you know, when you see some of the big time college coaches speak, you go down, you try to get a pick with them, you know, pick their brain for 10 seconds before the next person in the line's waiting. But I just remember, like, when after Coach Show spoke, I remember the first thing he did was he had his wife Vicky there and his grandkids we were in Wisconsin Dells, and he was talking about how he turned this into a little mini family vacation. And I don't know what it was, Mike, but like, I was like, this is the kind of guy that I need to be around and the kind of guy that I want to talk to and learn from, you know, like everything that I want to be as a man, as a coach. It seems like this guy's kind of got it figured out. And, you know, I went right down as soon as he was done speaking, I was the first one there. And, you know, he had mentioned he's running a camp called Snow Valley, and that was it, you know, and I told him I'd love to work camp. And from there, over the past close to 15 years now, we've just built a really strong relationship, and anything he's ever asked, I've been happy to do. And I'm not saying that that's all that happened, you know, because it was also meeting other people with USAB. It actually kind of, the 3-on-3 stuff started. And I think we talked about this last time, after my cousin was shot, I wanted to try to turn a negative to positive. So I was like, hey, let me do some youth clinics in the city just for free, you know, like in these, you know, different neighborhoods in Chicago, go to the park districts and do these free youth clinics, and then maybe do like these little 3-on-3 tournaments and just get the community together. You know, our city is kind of fragmented. Like, let's bring people together through basketball. And I had this idea, and that got me in touch with some people with USAB on the 3-on-3 side about, hey, I'd like to put on some 3-on-3 events, and they were looking for people to help do that. And I think that's kind of how that conversation started. And 7 or 8 years later, you know, fast forward, and I've done a lot of work with them, putting on tournaments and then working the national championships kind of on the op side of things and helping them run events. And then right before COVID hit in February, we All-Star Weekend, they had the teams in Chicago that they were considering for the Olympic teams, both the men and women. And it was kind of like the trials, if you will, of people they were considering for the final four of their rosters for both men and women. And, they asked me to help run some of the workouts and practices and just kind of be on site. And I got to work with some of the women's team that won the gold, you know, Kelsey Plum and Leisha Gray and Steph Dolson and all of them. So it was pretty cool. And I never really thought anything else would come from it from there, you know. And then this summer, actually, Mike, at Snow Valley, I got the call to be the coach, and I couldn't really say anything at the time, but that's how it all shook out. So, yeah, I don't know. I kind of jumped around there a little bit, but I think I answered your question.
No, you did. So what's that call like? It's just, hey, this is the opportunity. Are you interested? Is it – just what did that call sound like?
Yeah, yeah. Pretty much like – you know, I think USAB had a lot to figure out, and it's still COVID has changed everything for everybody. And I think they were still figuring out what they can do with their protocols and what was happening. And to be honest with you, obviously there was a lot that went into the Olympics, and then there was a lot that went in to our junior national teams, 5-on-5 teams playing this summer. And truth be told, it didn't, you know, they didn't really even officially know if the FIBA World Cup for the 3-on-3 side was going to happen. So it was kind of not thrown together, but there wasn't a whole lot of time. So I got the call in July about the tournament that was happening end of August, you know. So, you know, we got things pieced together and it went really well. And obviously we got the results we were going for, but, you know, the process along the way was really special. And obviously I'll never forget that moment. And, it was very special for me. And, obviously with an opportunity like that, it's not really a yes or no question. It's just whatever I got to do to make this work, it's going to happen. So that was the next process, step in the process.
So what does that look like when you are the head coach of a national 3-on-3 team? Where are the practices? What does it look like? How do you structure or approach a practice compared to how you might structure a practice with your high school team? How do you get to know the players? There's a million questions in there, but just kind of talk us through sort of the beginning weeks of how you kind of got things going.
Yeah. So, you know, the nice thing, before we even got together, we did have a few Zoom calls and, you know, got to talk to the players and their parents a little bit, obviously with USAB's leadership, and just touch base that way. And obviously we had another coach with us, Kelly Carruthers from Texas, who's amazing and successful in her own right. And she just stepped right in and was such a valuable asset. And then we had another guy on site when we did training camp in Chicago, Todd Muncy from Texas. Todd Muncy, who's, you know, another was just a wonderful asset on site. But, you know, once USA kind of gave us the freedom to speak to the players, we had our Zooms, you know, put together kind of our handbook and what we were looking at in terms of expectations and standards, started piecing together, you know, our first couple practice plans. And obviously, you know, just like with coaching 5-on-5, you're not going to do every practice plan for the whole, you know, for training camp. We're going to take it one day, see what works, what we need to cut out, what we need to fit in. And we were actually really fortunate, you know, anyone who's worked with USAB 3-on-3, you know, I actually was on a few calls with Joe Lewandowski, who is the men's coach, and Kara Lawson, the head coach at Duke, who is our women's coach, and got to pick their brain quite a bit. And, you know, from there, it just came down to, I mean, just the same way you're approaching 5-on-5, you're thinking about how are we going to be successful? What are we going to need to do really well? What are some of the nuances that we're going to need to figure out, you know, obviously sooner rather than later before international competition. And that was it. You know, we structured our practices a certain way. We had a few kind of DNA drills that we did every day when we worked out. We got a lot of shots up out of the actions that we were going to try to attack out of. But, you know, honestly, Mike, like when you're thinking of putting a 5-on-5 practice plan together, you know, on the defensive side of it, you're thinking about your coverages, you're thinking about how you're going to play ball screens. That was a huge part of what we did. Obviously, you're thinking about what your rotations are. And 3-on-3, there's no help side. So, you know, it really came down to us owning the idea that we were really going to guard our yard. And, you know, if you're not a great defensive team, you're not a gold medal team. And that was something we really sold both teams on early on. And on the offensive side, you know, with 3-on-3, you have your dead ball sets and then you have your live ball actions. And what was great, both the men's and women's teams, you know, a lot of our live ball actions and stuff we're doing in 5-on-5, Some of the angles are going to be a little different, obviously. You know, you get the clear out, so you're going to have a lot of uphill DHOs, a little uphill pass and chase ball screens. But, you know, conceptually, it's stuff that our players were familiar with. We just had to get them to buy into how we were attacking and the angles in which we needed to play. So that was really the big emphasis in training camp. And then obviously, like you said, creating a chemistry in not a whole lot of time. You know, I think some of the teams that we were playing, if not all of them, I mean, these are professionals. I mean, they're under 18, but they're playing this game year round. Some of them probably even getting paid to do it. So we knew coming in that we had a little bit of a learning curve, and I thought we did a really good job of attacking those that learning curve in practice and getting ourselves ready.
Talk a little bit about how the roster gets put together for a team like this. What's the process of choosing who's going to be on those teams?
Yeah, you know, so I didn't really get to have a big hand in that. You know, I kind of walked into a situation where the rosters were pretty much already set and you know, legitimized before I even really, you know, got on that first Zoom call. You know, I know from the past, obviously, they do these, you know, tournaments throughout the country, which leads to a national championship. And at the national championship, typically the you know, the team that wins the tournament is a part of a pool and a process that a you know, selection committee kind of then deems as the national team getting into competition. You know, with this year, not having, because of COVID, not having the opportunity to host the national championships, I think a lot of the selection came down to the committee just based on what they'd seen from players playing, some of them playing in other 3-on-3 events, but most of them really from their 5-on-5 resumes, you know. So I think one of the big things the committee, and just talking to the people that were in the room making these decisions, you know, obviously there's a premium. You got to be able to shoot the ball on 3-on-3. Players that are versatile, you know, that can guard bigs and smalls, you know, and because you're going to have a lot of switching. You know, a lot of the European teams are going to have very skill set similar players that are really going to want to shoot it. And I think that, you know, USA did an amazing job in putting the teams together and in the selection committee having players ready to go that would buy in, that were just great teammates, but also that fit the bill for what we were trying to do from a philosophical standpoint and how we were going to attack.
So when you're practicing, is it just the four players that are part of the team? Do you have other players who aren't part of the competition team that are there as part of the practice? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So we did training camp in the States before we left for Hungary. And at training camp, we had essentially, like you would with the Olympics or with international competition, we had a select team of players that had 3-on-3 experience, which really was great. I mean, we're not, you know, the players that we had, when I say 3-on-3 experience, I mean 3-on-3 experience in our country playing in these different events over the, you know, the course of the past few years. You know, they were all college level kids that were playing either, you know, playing at the college level now or whatever, you know, but they were, you know, it was nice to have that because there was some 3-on-3 acumen already in training camp. When we were, you know, obviously we can drill things to death, but at the end of the day, you're learning how to play 3-on-3. You actually need to be playing it live, which is, you know, that's the way we're going to learn the quickest. So we had that select team. We kind of talked them through what we were trying to do. We really put a, you know, kind of in our scout plans with them, the whole focus for the scout team was really trying to get clear outs quickly, you know, shoot a lot of twos because that's what we were going to be seeing. We knew with the international competition. And I thought our team, our select team did a wonderful job in getting us prepared. So
what were some of the quirks of the FIBA 3-on-3 game? Some people that are in the audience may be familiar with it. Some people may not be. And I don't want to go through the entire rules and break that all down, but just what's one or two things that maybe you felt like you really had to focus on that could give your team a little bit of an advantage when it comes to, I don't know if exploiting the rules is the right way, but just taking advantage of the way the rules are set up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, so I think a few of the things, well, one, it was really just, you know, you can't replicate the physicality. And, you know, it may be lost in translation when you're watching it on those YouTube live streams, but those teams are physical. It's a very different style of play internationally than what these, you know, our players playing 5-on-5, you know, in the United States. And I mean, the last competition all of these players were in was during, you know, AAU season in July. You know what I mean? And I'm not knocking any kind of product out there, but, you know, AAU is very free-flowing. You know, the premium is on skill set and getting up and down the floor. And I mean, we all know that's what the model is, you know. And, you know, as much as we try to replicate it in training camp, you know, those first two games we played, we noticeably, you know, felt the difference. And the referees aren't going to call it super tight, right? Because with the FIBA rules, what we learned very quickly is, as much as we talked about it, you know, fouls change everything. You know, I mean, they do in 5-on-5, but with FIBA, after you get into the bonus, so if you end up fouling a seventh time, the opponent gets two shots automatically, right? Now, it's ones and twos in the, you know, 3-on-3, and you're playing to 21 or the end of 10 minutes expires. So you can have, you know, there were times we were up 4 or 5 points, but all of a sudden now we're in the bonus, they're shooting two shots. And if you get to double bonus, if you get to 10 free throws, they're shooting two shots and getting the ball back. So you're talking about potentially anywhere from a 3 to 4 point swing every time you foul. So, you know, the first two games we played, the teams were very physical with us, but they understood what being physical without getting called for ticky-tack fouls looked like. And I don't think we did. But after our first game, I thought we really adjusted well and kind of started figuring that out. And what we really sold our players on was, you know, if we make this a basketball game and not, you know, a free throw shooting contest, you know, I think we're gonna do what we set out to do. We've got to defend without fouling, and we can't let the physicality get us emotional. And I think that those are two of the, you know, the really big things that we focused on that really got us to where we wanted to go.
So I didn't realize, as I was poring over and researching for hours and hours to prepare for this interview, I did not realize that you were not allowed to coach at all during the games. So clearly, as a coach, that is a completely different and unique experience, unless you've been a tennis coach, I guess, where you can't coach during a match. So what was it like to sit on the sidelines and watch your players? Obviously, from a development standpoint for the players, there's tremendous benefit to them having to work their way through it and figure it out on their own and go back and think about what they had worked on or what you had talked with them about previously. But sitting there as a coach, it had to be extremely, I'll just use the word challenging. So just tell us what that was like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, come on. Like, if we've all coached and we all know how much we care and put into this thing. And you know, then you get to the chance to compete and you're not able to make adjustments with your team. Like, it's frustrating. But, you know, I did. I remember seeing Kara Lawson after they won gold. And she was on an interview with NBC. And, I mean, she's a Hall of Famer. She's an unbelievable player. She's won at the college level. She's won gold medals as a player with USAB. She coached with the Boston Celtics. She's head coach at Duke. Like, she's a 5-on-5 player, 5-on-5 coach. But she mentioned in the interview, she's like, you know, coaching 3-on-3, as much as, you know, we're preparing and pouring in at practice, but when the game starts, it's like you have to trust that your players are prepared and they're going to rise to the level of their training and that they are going to handle it in the heat of the moment, and you have to kind of just trust it. And it's kind of liberating. And you know what? I mean, don't get me wrong. Obviously, you know, when teams made a little run or, you know, in both of those gold medal games, we were down early. Obviously, if I'm coaching, there's a timeout and we're refocusing and getting us kind of back bought into the game plan. But you just can't do it. And I guess the moral of the story is, as frustrating as it was, in both of those gold medal games, when our players did figure it out and the light bulb went on and it clicked, like, I don't know that I've had a more cathartic experience in all my years of coaching. Like, it was just like, wow, you saw it click. you saw all the work that we put in, just kind of like, you know, we figured it out and we did what we needed to do. And we got then to, you know, to the task at hand, winning a gold medal, and talk about rewarding, you know. And it's like, they got it. They bought in, you know, all the things we had been talking about. They figured it out for themselves. And it reminds me, as a 5-on-5 coach now, I hope I can have that same mindset going in coaching my teams, you know, here in Chicago. Like, there's going to be times where your players have to figure things out. You can't hold their hands. Like, you know, and it's, you know, I hear Coach Show talk about how basketball is the most overcoached and undertaught sport. Like, we earn our keep in practice as coaches, right? Like, we've got to pour in practice. We've got to prepare in practice. That's when we're got to be at our best. But when we get into the games, you know, our players are the ones making plays. And as much as a timeout or adjustment helps, like, the players got to know how to handle things. And I don't know. Like, it was kind of a cool moment. I'm not going to lie to you. It was really cool when that happened. So I think I answered your question. But still, don't get me wrong. It was frustrating.
Absolutely. I can only imagine. And yet, at the same time, I think there's a tremendous lesson to be learned in that I think so often, and I'm going to equate it to not only coaches, but you think about parents in the stands directing players at all levels, and you think about coaches and different styles, obviously, for different coaches. But the fact that ultimately, really what we want to do, and I think you said it pretty well, is that you want to be able to equip your players through practice with the tools that they need to be able to make those adjustments and learn the game and make good decisions and figure things out on the fly. And that's when you really, really have the type of team that anybody would love to coach. Now, your hand is obviously forced, as you said. If you had the opportunity to call timeout and get in there and make adjustments, you obviously would have. But at the same time, when you weren't able to do that, it sort of forced the player's hand. So, hey, you've got to figure out what you need to do. And obviously, there are things that you've talked about in practice and that you've prepared them for, and situations to look for where, hey, you might want to try this if this is happening, or here's a situation where we might want to call a timeout and change the momentum or look at something different. And I think that ultimately speaks to what a good coach really does, which is empower their players to make those kinds of decisions. And it sounds like you felt like your kids were able to do that, your players were able to do that and make the kind of adjustments that they needed to make in order to have the type of success. Is that kind of how you looked at it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, 100%, you know. And, you know, I think, I don't know, it's like, that's what this is supposed to be all about, right? The idea of getting our players to figure things out. And I mean, obviously, when you even get into the bigger picture, right, like the life lessons that go with playing high school, college level basketball, whatever level we're coaching, we're trying to give players tools, and we're trying to give them, you know, equip them with the ability to figure things out and make decisions and be a part of a unit. And I mean, when you're able to see them talk through something, when you're able to see them, you know, the light bulb click and realize, hey, like, this is our game plan. We're not executing and this is happening. But if we actually do what we're supposed to do, good things are going to happen. And then you see them find that confidence. And it's like, it's almost like when you get to watch them do it without you, like, and again, when we're coaching, it's 5-on-5 and you're able to scream and shout and call timeouts, like, you don't see that unfold as much. You're kind of like, so in the moment. I mean, again, we're in the moment 3-on-3, but you know what I mean? Like, you're not kind of like seeing it. Whereas in 3-on-3, you're seeing it and you're seeing it unfold. And it's again, it's special. So 100%, man.
What's the moment like when the anthem's being played and you're standing there with your team? I know that whatever words you come up with probably aren't going to be able to do it justice of how you felt, but can you give us 30 seconds on what it was like to stand there with the anthem playing with the players after all that you had gone through to be able to win the tournament? Just describe that for us.
One of the things we talked about with the players, like, this wasn't just, I mean, as much as it was like this 2 to 3 week process, this was a lifelong dream realized for all of us. You know, the players, the coaches, Jay and Andrea, who worked with us at USAB, and the whole staff, like our trainer, Laura, like this was something that, you know, and for me personally, like, I mean, the lifelong dream, the biggest dream I've ever dreamed. I mean, outside of being the husband to my wife and the father to my children, you know, on that side of things, the greatest dream I've ever dreamed in my life, that almost seemed like it could never happen because it was such a lofty dream, was getting a chance to represent USA basketball in international competition. And I mean, just now talking about it, getting emotional because it's the greatest dream I've ever dreamt. And when we got to stand there, and again, it wasn't about me, it was about those players and their commitment, but just to get to be a part of it. And when you hear that anthem and you got the, you know, they got the gold medals around their necks. I mean, I don't know, Mike, like I can't even start to put into words. It was the greatest honor of my life. And outside of being the father to my children and the husband to my wife, there's really nothing else like that. And, you know, I mean, I don't think I could really say anything else about it. It was pretty special, man. You know, it was, and then, you know what? I mean, we got to hear it twice that night, which that was, you know, with the men and women winning it. So it was a pretty cool experience, man.
Well said. What was the relationship like between the two teams in terms of their camaraderie and how you handled that piece of it on the trip?
Yeah, man. I mean, Mike, that was too like, holy cow. Like, you know, I mean, again, I don't really have a basis for comparison. I've worked with the 5-on-5 men's junior national team at camps, but I haven't traveled, so I don't know what that experience is like. But I mean, and again, I mean, even just coaching 5-on-5 here as a high school coach, and you know, you're with your team, you're with your men's team, and there's whatever 12, 15, 16 guys, and that's it, you know, and that's the bond, and that's the whole deal. But like with this 3-on-3 thing, we've got, you know, 4 women and 4 men coming from all over the country, coming together. And it's like, you don't just have to worry about the dynamic of the men's team or the women's team and how they're going to gel. Like, we're traveling together. We're eating meals together. We're doing team bonding together. We're, you know, watching film together, you know, a lot of times. And, I don't know, man, I loved it. It was one of the coolest things to not just get one team bought into a game plan and the way they're going to play and accomplishing their tasks. It kind of became like this thing where, like, I even heard one of the players say it after. It's like, well, if we won it and you didn't, or you won it and we didn't, it's like we wouldn't have won. You know what I mean? It was kind of like the women wanted so badly for the men to win, and the men wanted the women so badly to win. It was like they were all in this invested together. And they just wore USA across their chest so proudly that it became like this joint effort. You know what I mean? And it kind of became like a brotherly, sisterly thing. Like, we're all in this together. We all have one mission. And again, it was like there was really 13 of us traveling together, from the 8 players and the coaches, coaching staff, and myself and Kelly, and then Laura, our trainer, and then Jay and Andrea. And it's like, as a unit, like we did everything together, and it was one of the coolest things I've ever been a part of. Right. Like, and it was kind of fun. Like, when there was like a tough moment for the guys team, you know, the women's team was there to kind of get us going. And when there was kind of a tough moment for the women's team, the guys were there, you know, to have their backs. And it was like, man, this is special. Like, this is different. This is unlike anything I've ever really been a part of. And I loved it. I loved every second of it.
What were some of the fun highlights away from the court, just in terms of the international travel to Hungary? I don't know what kind of experience the players had traveling internationally and how many of them had been elsewhere, but just what was it like from a cultural standpoint of the travel piece of it and just some of the things that you were able to do off the court?
Yeah. So it's, you know, We were really quarantined and kind of in this bubble and, you know, masked up and in the hotel and really didn't get to leave the hotel. You know, and we really, and again, kudos to USA Basketball and again, Andrea and Jay's, you know, Jay Demings, I know he's been on the podcast before, their leadership in keeping us on task and making sure we had everything we needed, and keeping us safe and making sure we were upholding all the protocols. Like, they were rock stars, man, you know. But I think, you know, the players, most of them have never been out of the country. There was a few who had. And, you know, I think one of the first things we talked about, like, you know, at our first kind of meeting together, like, we're going to be gone away from our families for quite a bit. We're going to be in another country. We're going to be doing this together. So we really need to make sure that we're sharing this experience and we're there for each other. Some of us might get home. I told them I'm going to be homesick. I mean, this is the longest I was going to be away from my kids and wife, you know, my whole experience as a father and husband. So we talked about that, but it was kind of like we kind of soaked up everything together from the airport, going through customs, you know, getting into Hungary in the long bus ride. And then we get to the hotel, and the first day we get there, it's kind of like we have to be quarantined to our room until the COVID test clears. And we do like a game night and just had a blast with that. And then we're eating all of our meals together. And, like, there are so many highlights. Like, we had a lot of fun off the court figuring things out. But I don't know. To me, I don't know. I just, you know, I hear it all the time, the idea of, like, breaking bread together and having meals. Like, there were just a lot of jokes over our dinners, and just the little hangouts in the lobby that were kind of priceless. A lot of inside jokes, just like you get with any team, you know. And those are things that we're all going to remember, you know. And there's little text threads going back and forth with some of those jokes still, you know. That's kind of what makes it all worthwhile, and that's what makes the experience so gratifying, is when you get to know people really for who they are, and you kind of dig beneath the surface, and you know, real relationships form. So, yeah, there was a bunch. I mean, I probably say the funniest thing that happened, I think you guys saw it live in a game, one of our players, Janaya, she just was scared of bees, and there was so many bees in the stands and around, like, chasing us, I felt like, at times. But she was getting, you know, with the 3-on-3, you sub every dead ball, and she was checking into a game after Michaela made a really big play, and Janaya was checking in, and a bee started chasing her, and it looked like Janaya was almost, like, doing a TikTok dance. And it's like, I guess I rewatched all the games multiple times after to break down film. And the announcer's saying, like, what is wrong with Janaya? It looks like she's doing some kind of dance. And Michaela was cracking up. And Janaya just left the court and subbed herself right back out. Like, she just came in because she was just like, I'm not dealing with this beat. And, like, I feel like it kind of became a meme. Like, FIBA 3-on-3 posted it and made a big joke about it. And, like, then from then on, every team in the tournament, that was kind of like our way to break the ice. Like, everyone was kind of joking around, like, oh, that's the way to beat Team USA. We got some bees ready to, you know, so it kind of became a thing. And that was kind of cool because that broke the ice. Like, I go over there, I don't know what to expect, you know, like, are these other countries, are they going to want to talk to us? And by the end of the tournament, you know, we were, you know, talking and sharing stories with the Hungarian coaches and the German coaches. And I mean, it was pretty cool. And I think Janaya being so afraid of bees is kind of like the start to all of that. So, but anyway,
that's cool. Yeah. That's a very cool story. And again, yeah, it's one of those things that it means even more to all of you who were a part of it. As anybody who's ever been on a team, whether you're a player or whether you're a coach, there are always those little quirks and those little things that happen that for whatever reason you latch onto, and they kind of grow in stature over time. And they're things that it's like those girls and the guys on the team, again, 30 years from now, they're just going to be able to say the word B, send yes. somebody a text, you know, and send them a little B emoji, and everybody's right. going to know. Everybody's going to know exactly what that means. It's going to take you all back to exactly where you were in that moment. And that is something that can never be replaced. And I think it sounds like that you were able to generate that with, as you said, this diverse group of players that came from all over the country, didn't necessarily even know each other very well, if they knew each other at all prior to coming together. And yet you were able to have this unbelievable experience. Hey coaches, Jason and I here at the Hoopheads Pod know you're always looking to learn and grow. So we've teamed up with Matt Smith from United Basketball Clinics to bring you our first ever Buckeye Coaches Clinic. The clinic will be held at Olmsted Falls High School in Olmsted Falls, Ohio on Saturday, September 25th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m.
You can get registered by visiting hoopheadspod.com and clicking on Buckeye Coaches Clinic from the main menu. We've put together a great lineup of speakers for coaches at all levels of the game. Bring your whole staff and get $10 off each registration. Visit hoopheadspod.com for more info and join us for a great day of basketball at the Buckeye Coaches Clinic.
You mentioned breaking down film. What did the scouting process look like during the tournament and watching film of 3-on-3 compared to watching film of 5-on-5 as a high school coach? Just what did it look like? How did you do it? And then how would you compare the two if there was any similarities or differences that stand out?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I feel like after we got out of training camp, when you know, the focus there was like getting our stuff in and getting them competing and learning the rules, you know, I kind of felt like my hat kind of switched once we actually got to Hungary and started competition. That was a week-long process. But it really – I thought, you know, the players are going to show up and they're going to play the games. But I kind of really felt that, you know, between myself and Kelly, like we're going to – like our job is to get into this film and to have some edits ready for our players and to make sure we're getting edits of ourselves and ways we can improve, but also – getting scout of our opponents and really getting to know who they were and how they were going to attack us. What was really cool, one of the big things that I actually end up speaking to some of the coaches about after and just some different people, like, you know, you're breaking down a 5-on-5 game, you know, at the high school level in Illinois anyway, you know, it's a 32-minute game. You got the 4 8-minute quarters. And that can be an arduous process at times, you know, like we, you know, like with Lane, we use a software system and we send our film and we get the edit back and it's like, okay, now that it's clipped out, it saves us some time, but it's still, you know, you're going through, you know, 100 some odd clips and really trying to put reels together and such. And then you got practice the next day and they had another game another night later. So, you know, it can be time consuming and you kind of need a group at the high school level to kind of share the load, you know, with the 3-on-3 games. Obviously, number one, I'm getting these games right off YouTube just like anybody else is, but it's a 10-minute game, right? So pretty much all of our opponents, I try to get as many films as I could. And what I had to do, again, working with just my laptop and not really having access to a whole lot of things, just screen recording clips and then putting them together in edits for our coach or for our players. And then we would, you know, I would end up messaging them a bunch of clips I wanted them to kind of look at before. And then the morning of game day, you know, we'd have our practice, like just we got 15 minutes or 20 minutes on the court. We do just a quick walkthrough, get some shots up, and then we come back and have film edits of our opponent that day. And then usually after the night of competition, we would have some film of our game. So now, you know, like we get there, it was like the women played Tuesday, men played Wednesday, women played Thursday, men played Friday, Saturday was quarters, Sunday was semis and finals. So, you know, there was obviously film in the morning, film at the night for the team that played that day, but then also a film session for the team that was waiting to play. You know what I mean? So in between games, in between practices, it was me locking myself in the room and Kelly locking herself in the room. And even Todd back home, who's one of our court coaches in training camp, looking at film, getting stuff clipped out and broken down and having these edits ready for our players. And, you know, I'd like to think that, you know, these edits did prepare them. And I think that, you know, them seeing some of the things that our opponents were going to do gave them some confidence going into our games, you know, because, I mean, obviously you go into 5-on-5 in the States, yeah, you're going to play a really good high school, you know, like some of these guys play, you know, play AAU or whatever, but there's a little familiarity, right? You're going in, you know, some of these players already, you've seen them, you know, some of the stuff they're going to run. Even if you haven't seen a whole lot of film, there's just some things you're familiar with. You know, us going to a whole nother country and us coming together in such a short amount of time, like there was a lot of uncertainty. And I think that the film, you know, they always say people lie, right? You know, film never lies. So I think the film really gave them confidence heading into competition. I think if you did watch our teams over the you know, week-long games that we played, there was some definite growth over that time. And obviously it was the players buying in, but I think it was the familiarity and the, you know, the picking things up so quickly. And I think the film did help with that.
How much practice time did you get when you were there?
When we were there, like I said, man, we only had So what would end up happening the day of a game, right? So like the women would play two games in the afternoon. They would have essentially a 20-minute. Sometimes, it, you know, the first day I think we had 30, but most of the days it was between 15 and 20 minutes on the court to get shots up in the mornings. And we would do just a couple of drills where you get a lot of shots out of some of our actions, and then we would do some basic prep, scout prep for our upcoming games that day. So then like a typical day would be like wake up early, you know, women have breakfast super early between 7 and 7:30. They get taped, they get see the trainer, whatever. We head over to our practice from, you know, whatever it is, 8:15 to 8:45, come back, watch film. While that film's happening, the guys are at breakfast. Girls go back, they rest up a little bit, get into their uniforms. We walk over with the men to their actual day off half-hour practice, go through a half-hour practice, come back, potentially watch some film. They get some lunch. We head over to the women's game. We're watching our women's game. Then we're staying and scouting the teams in between. Then we have another women's game. Then we come back, and then it's more film and dinner and then film with the guys. And then the next day, just do it all over again, you know. So – like as much as I talked about, like we were, you know, we were all kind of missing our families and in a way, like you didn't really have time. You know what I mean? Like every day was so jam packed. It really did kind of fly by.
What did you learn strategically that you might be able to bring back to Lane with you? Is there anything that you saw either that you guys put together or something that one of your opponents was running or a defensive, whatever, defensive style, something that you saw from an X's and O's or a strategic standpoint or a skill development standpoint that you could bring back that can benefit you as a high school coach?
Yeah, honestly, Mike, there was a lot. I mean, I have a whole notebook of stuff. And honestly, like some of these film edits that I have saved, we're going to be watching some of this with our team to prep because – you know, obviously, you know, even before I was doing any of this stuff with USAB, I think we've all talked about this. Like, you use 3-on-3 breakdown in your practices. Like, I don't really care where you're coaching, what you're doing. You do some 3-on-3 work, whether it's, you know, your ball screen actions, your post splits, you know, 3-on-3 just to play and see who our better defenders are. You know, 3-on-3 rebounding drills. Like, you do a lot of breakdown with 3-on-3. 3-on-3 shell breakdown. You know, I was doing that stuff when I first started coaching back in 2005, 2006. And it was stuff I did when I was playing in college, you know. And I think one of the big things that I took away in terms of strategy, you know, and again, the game has evolved to a place now where obviously the premium is on in 5-on-5, the 3-point shot, and 3-on-3, we call it, you know, the 2-point shot. But there's a premium there. And when you have shooters, you know, you're trying to design your offense to get those shots, force long closeouts. And some of the – actually, I think some of the stuff that we put in was pretty good, some of the stuff we were running. But there were some things that our opponents ran, you know, and, you know, not to put everyone's scout out there for the world to hear, but, you know, there was like this post-split action that Estonia did that I really loved. You know, typically, you know, just like talking through it, like your pass would be made to the post – and that passer would then have a read to either kind of cut or set a screen for another player and get a post split. And what Estonia would do is like that low man who would make the entry, the top man would come and almost kind of come and change the angle and pin him, the passer, to the dead corner. And it was very hard to guard because it happened so quickly. And they were getting that look very cleanly the first time we played them. And I think we made some really great adjustments. We ended up playing them in the gold medal game for the men. But that was an action that I'm definitely going to steal. you know, it worked really well. It was hard to guard. And there's a lot of that kind of stuff. Like, it was crazy how, like, because, again, it's a different points per possession deal too, right? Like, in 5-on-5, you know, you're shooting threes for twos. You shoot 10 threes, you get 30 points. You shoot, you know, 10 twos, you get 20 points. But in the you know 3-on-3 game, you shoot 10 twos, you get 20 points. You shoot 10 ones, you know, you're getting 10 points. And a game, it could be over at 21. You know what I mean? So, like, there's such a premium on the 2-point shot. And I think a lot of the teams that we played knew their only chance of really beating our talent was to make a lot of twos or to get us into foul trouble or a combination of both. So the way we defended the three-point line, there's a lot of things that we did that I'm definitely going to bring back home with our teams, and also the way to generate those three-point shots. And it was almost like some of the teams that we played, they'd run a ball screen action, and the roll man, even if we gave the roll up, they'd hit the roll for a kickout for a two. They'd have some post actions. Just even if we wouldn't dig down, right? But even if we did, the whole idea was to post up to get an action for a two, right? So there was a lot of good stuff. And again, like I said, there's going to be definitely some stuff that I steal. So
when you think about that and the way that the game has evolved, and obviously, as you said, 3-on-3 places an even greater premium on that 2-point/3-point shot. As a coach, and you've seen the game evolve from when you started, where there wasn't nearly the emphasis on the three as there is in the game today. And as I'm hearing you talk, what I'm picturing in my head is the things that when I'm watching basketball today, that still as an old school player/coach, when I see a 3-on-1 and it's an automatic layup, and I see guys fanning out to the three-point line, there's still a part of me that, even though I understand the math and I understand the analytics, there's still a part of me that cringes when I see that. And yet, when you're talking about the 3-on-3, it's almost like conceding a one isn't that painful when you know on the other side of it, you're going to come back and shoot a two, if that makes any sense. And so how do you think about that from a coaching standpoint, whether that's how you thought about it in the 3-on-3 or whether how you think about that as a high school coach in terms of shot selection and what you're trying to generate from your offense?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Mike. And you know, it's funny, like, come on, man. Like, I've never coached a team like this in my life. Like, both the men and the women, all 8 of those players were the most talented players. I mean, holy cow. You know, obviously, I've gotten to work with the junior national team and coaching those guys in that setting, right? And that's obviously those experiences, and then this experience, that's the most talent I've ever been around. And those players are able to score at all three levels, you know, and in a variety of ways. They know what they're good at. And they're good at a lot of things, but you know, I think what I kind of saw happening was, like, every team that we played, if they tried to play us, and I'm talking with FIBA, with the 3-on-3 experience with USAB, if they tried to play us straight up and play basketball, they knew they weren't going to beat us, right? Trading ones. They weren't going to beat us trading ones. We were going to score more efficiently. Any game we played, we just had more. We had an unbelievable amount of talent, and we had guys at different levels. I mean, obviously, you know, when you look at both teams, we had players who could score on the block, and they really couldn't stop us. We had players who were really good in pick and roll, players who could knock down the open jump shot, and really all 8 players were able to do that. So, I think when I was thinking about, like, scout, like, a lot of these teams, like you just said, like, they don't want to concede ones with us, but, like, at times they were like, okay, they beat us in that action. They're going to give a one. We're not going to follow them. We can't follow the United States, because then we're really in trouble. And they would leak out to try to get a quick two from it. And they actually even had designed actions to get those shots. But, you know, on our side of it, like, we really stress, we're not falling in love with all twos, right? Like, we don't need to do that. Like, let's be efficient. Let's take the ones where we can get them. Let's put the emphasis, you know, let's put the pressure on them by attacking the rim. They're going to have to follow you or give up a bunch of ones, and that's going to open up a lot of things. But, you know, to your question, as a high school coach here in Chicago, like, and we've talked about this before, a lot of times I'm coaching the team in our league that is, you know, and I'm not saying anything bad about our school. We're playing very talented teams in our league. Most of our teams in our league have some high major Division I players, and we have unbelievable kids, but we don't have that talent level just naturally. So we are the team philosophically that we're trying to make more threes than our opponent. We're really you know, like that's our goal. We know we need to try to make 8 to 10 threes a game, and we're driving and kicking and we're doing all those things. Now, we're not conceding twos. It's a different
right,
game.
Right, right.
But to your point, and then like in the transition though, I still get where you're coming from. Like we got a clean layup and you're leaking out for three. Like unless it's our, you know, and again, who has a Steph Curry? You know, no one has a Steph Curry, you know, so it's hard for me still to concede that. Like when we know we got a basket, let's get the basket. We always talk about on our end, getting back to lane real quick, like conversion offense, like we're trying to get a layup, a free throw opportunity where we force a foul, or a puncture three, right? Like we're not just fanning out, like unless there's a paint touch where we've collapsed the defense, we're not shooting that three in transition. So that's kind of like our, you know, that's kind of my OCD way of dealing with the fact that they're going to shoot threes in transition.
Right. No, it makes a ton of sense. It's just, again, like I said, it's always interesting when the evolution of the game has gone in a direction that is different from the way that I spent the majority of my playing and coaching career dealing with it. And it's just you look at the math and you say, well, we can give them one if we're going to get two on the other end. And in the three-on-three, it skews even more.
Right.
Where you know, you think about the old Paul Westhead running up and down Loyola Marymount teams.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, that's almost – they were ahead of their time in terms of, hey, we're just going to – we just want to get you into this tempo and we'll give you a quick two because we're going to come down and we're going to – shoot threes on the other end.
Right.
And we just want to get you tired and get you running and playing our style of play. And it's sort of the same thing here where you can see where these teams, if you're not as talented and it's not as easy for you to score and you look at it, you say the only way we can win is to stand behind the line and have an exceptionally hot shooting game that sure we'll give you ones because we could just shoot twos. And in that 3-on-3 game, obviously it's the math is even more skewed in favor of shooting two. So it's really, to me, I find it to be fascinating, just the whole interplay between what conceptually may have been a good shot 15 years ago versus what conceptually is a good shot today. It's completely different. Shots that coaches that I might have played for 30 years ago would have been cringing, just to put it in a nice way, if some of the shots that go flying all the time today are taken. So it's just interesting. It's amazing the way that the game has changed. And I think that the 3-on-3 is taking it to a whole nother dimension. I know you and I have talked about it before, and you mentioned it in when you were talking earlier about coaches incorporating 3-on-3 into their practices. We know that's something that's always been done in breakdowns and whatever. But I think the game, when you see the FIBA style of 3-on-3, and you look at the fact that now it's an Olympic sport, I think you're going to continue to see more and more and more of it. And it's just fun because if you played it or watched it or coached it, players get so many more touches. And I think one thing that I'd love to see, and I've said it on the podcast a couple times, is I think you could make a pretty coherent argument that if kids played nothing but 3-on-3 until they were in seventh grade, that our basketball skill level as a country would be way higher just because of the number of touches and the number of actions that every player has to be involved in, both on offense and on defense.
I couldn't agree more. I think we're going to start seeing some of that trending. I think it's going to take time, but I mean, if you're someone who really is around the game, obviously, like you're watching these kids in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, going to these leagues, playing 5-on-5, running up and down the floor. Like, I mean, how much basketball do they really get in that 30 minutes that they were playing a 5-on-5 game, right? You may have touched the ball for 10 seconds. Like, what did you learn? Did you learn spacing when you're that young? Like, no, you're not getting these concepts, you know? And I think, as you said, even through middle school, you know, with 3-on-3, like we talked about, you're getting a lot of touches. You can't hide defensively. You've got to know what kind of actions you're running and how easy that can just translate into the 5-on-5. Obviously, you're adding on offense. I mean, let's talk about it. A lot of these actions are happening. You're adding the two guys in the corners as your shooters, or you're adding a post or whatever you're going to add. But a lot of the actions are going to be the same. And now defensively, you had to guard your yard until you're 12, 13 years old. You know what on-ball defense looks like. You know what kind of stunt recover potential looks like. And now you add the help side in the rotations, right? Like, I don't know. It makes a whole lot of sense to me as well. But obviously, there's a lot of layers to that too. So no, no question. We'll unpack that right now.
yeah. We can leave that for a whole other podcast. Yeah. But I would love to see it. I would love to see it happen. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
All right. Any final thoughts on the gold medal winning experience before we move on and talk about a couple other things and bring you back closer to home?
No, I mean, just thank you for letting me relive it here for the past however long we've been talking about it. I mean, it was special, obviously. You can't take it for granted. It's an experience that I will cherish for the rest of my life. And it was just the honor of a lifetime and incredibly, incredibly thankful for the opportunity and for the experience. So that's all I really got, man. Thank you.
That's awesome. And congratulations to you. Congratulations to the team, both teams. And it's obviously special, and it clearly comes through as you're talking how important and special it was for you, not just to win the gold medal, but to build relationships with the people that you were able to build relationships with over the course of this time. Are you tired of slipping and sliding on the court and sticky sheets just aren't giving you grip? Grip Spritz solves this problem without having to lick your hand to clean your shoes. Grip Spritz is used by countless AAU, high school and college programs, semi-pro teams, as well as NCAA athletes and G League players. Unlike other products, Grip Spritz has solutions for individual players, not just entire teams. We've used Grip Spritz at our Head Start basketball camps and players love it. To keep you and your team from slipping and sliding, visit gripspritz.net to learn more.
Let's bring you back to Chicago, and I want to talk two more things. First, I want to talk a little bit about Chicago Glow, and it was something that you and I, after the first time we met, and you kind of had a vision, and we're talking about this, so we'll give you a chance to talk about that in a second. And then at the end, just want to let you share with coaches out there what your experience has been like in Chicago at Lane through this whole COVID process. And we thought maybe two or three months ago that we were going to be almost through it. Now it looks like we're headed back to who knows what. So we'll leave that for the very end. But tell us a little bit about Chicago Glow, your vision for it, where it came from, and what you're hoping to do with that program.
Yeah. So, I think when you and I first started talking, I kind of had this vision for a while, and I really wasn't moving on it and was getting a little frustrated. And honestly, again, I still do. I remember that phone call we had. I remember driving home from work, and I just kind of stayed in the car on the phone with you for quite a while, because it was, you know, I think when you hear other people like you, what you're doing with your podcast and your camps, people who are going after their passions through the game, it's inspiring. And, you know, I just love being in the gym. You know, I think like a lot of coaches, I have a passion, obviously, for coaching basketball and trying to impact lives through something that I'm passionate about. I think that's what purpose is, using your passion to serve, you know. And as much as I get my fix coaching at Lane, my alma mater, and now obviously getting to work with USAB a little bit whenever that happens, obviously it's incredibly rewarding and love it. But I really wanted to say, hey, man, in the summer months, like, I'd like to really give back to our community. I'd like to coach more. I'd like to be in the gym with kids who really are passionate and are gym rats. And, you know, for a long time, I would just, you know, we'd do our youth camps at Lane, but, you know, I remember going to an outdoor park and just working out, and like little kids being there, and just like, they just wanted to, like, anything, you know, hey, you play basketball, can you help me? And it's like, what a great feeling, you know? I mean, truly, I just kind of wanted to do some more of that too, when I could find some time. And as you know, three young kids at home, it's kind of hard to find the time. But finally, this summer, I reached out to a local gym space and got a pretty good deal on some court space. And I just put something together, you know, where we did in the spring, we just did these kind of one day pop-ups, just to get the name out and kind of show what we were doing. And then finally this summer, we launched our first, we call it Chicago Glow Basketball School. The idea, it's not just a camp. You're not just showing up, you get your t-shirt and leaving. Like, there's a curriculum involved, you know, there's a report card at the end. Obviously, not trying to steal Coach Showalter and what Snow Valley has done, that's obviously kind of the inspiration, you know, and Snow Valley has meant so much to so many different people, from Snow Valley, California, Snow Valley, Iowa, Snow Valley, Missouri. But, you know, I'm not in a position where I'm, you know, gonna try to bring a whole Snow Valley to Chicago. I don't have a college, I don't have dorms, I don't have that, but I figured in my own little way, you know, and the idea of the name Chicago Glow, like the idea of being light in our city, like the game can unify. I think Chicago has it's beautiful. I think it's the best city in the world. But unfortunately, there are a lot of kids who get lost in the city, and a lot of kids who basketball is a tool for them. So the idea is that we're going to use basketball. We're going to provide opportunities for kids who really want to get after it and learn the game, and slowly but surely evolve it to a place where I'm hoping, you know, right now we just did a couple sessions where it was the school and the kids went through the curriculum, got the report card, but I would like to get out into other communities and branch out and even offer some free workouts and camps and even potentially get into this, to the, you know, the helping youth coaches get some development. You know, I think a lot of coaches that are in middle school, high school, college coaching, they'll go to clinics, they'll go to workshops. But what about some of those coaches that are just on the front lines with the kids at the park districts or at the Y that are just good people that want to help kids, but maybe don't have the basketball acumen, you know? So really, I'd really like to dive in deeper to that as the years evolve here. But that's kind of the vision. And I'm really happy we got it started this summer. And we'll see what, you know, once this basketball season ends, what year two will look like next spring and summer. So
I think that youth coach piece is really something that just like the 3-on-3, I think it's not always easy to do, to be able to get to those coaches who coach our second, third, fourth graders. A lot of times they're often parents. As you said, they're people that are good people that maybe aren't basketball centric, for lack of a better way of saying it, but by getting them the opportunity to help them to understand better how to be a coach, and not just from a basketball standpoint, but just how do you connect with kids? Because I think of all the conversations, Nick, that we've had on the podcast with different coaches, and sure, we talk a lot about different X's and O's stuff. We talk a lot about specifics when it comes to how do I teach this or what's that all about when you're out on the basketball floor. But so many of the conversations ultimately end up coming back to how do you connect with the players that you're coaching. And I think that's something that a lot of us who are in education, whether we're teachers or we're coaches or we're both, I think you sometimes take it for granted your ability to develop relationships with kids and manage kids and figure it out. And I don't even know if I've told this story on the podcast, but I think it's one that's relevant here. I remember one time I went to my kids' field day when I was, they were younger. So this was when my two of my older ones, when they were in elementary school, and there was a group of, you know, whatever, 25 kids, and there were two parents there. There was one dad and one mom, and they had a group and they were trying to organize the groups into like three teams. And I was kind of walking towards them and I see what's going on. And somebody had told me, hey, can you go over and help this group? And you're just watching them and they're trying to organize it.
Yep.
And you're just watching them going, I can't even watch this. Like, I don't even know what you're trying to accomplish. And I walk over there and you just forget that because you're in that kind of environment with kids all the time and you interact with them, that just getting a group of 25 kids into three teams, like I had it done in 5 seconds, but those other parents would have struggled with that for another 5 or 10 minutes, and then it still probably wouldn't have gone smoothly. And that has nothing to do with whether or not you can coach basketball or teach a skill or whatever. It's just a matter of how do you organize. And I think there's such a value in helping our youth coaches, our volunteer coaches, forget about basketball. I mean, I'm talking about any level, the people that spend time with our kids, especially, I'm sure, and again, I'm not as familiar, obviously, with inner city Chicago as you are, but I'm sure that the people who are there working with kids in that environment, if you could help them forget about the basketball specific techniques, but just how do I build better relationships with kids? How do I better organize this group that has a ton of energy. How do I get them into teams? How do I organize them into this so that we can get whatever it is that we're trying to do? How do we get that done? And to me, if somebody could figure out how to do that, I think we'd have, I mean, the impact you could have on the youth of the United States would be incredible.
Yeah. No, man, Mike, I'm with you. And I see it all the time. You see it, like, there are a lot of good people who care about kids, and just getting them a little know-how, and like you said, they might even have, like you said, the management skills to get people organized and get them in groups. Maybe you need a little basketball acumen. Or on the other side of it, maybe you are a former player and you've got all the acumen in the world, but maybe you don't know how to relate to the younger kids. Maybe they, like, you always understood it as a player, but these little guys you're trying to coach don't get
right,
it. So,
exactly.
You know, I think there's just such a good space for that. And I'm hoping that whether it's through Chicago Glow or just other opportunities, I just have a passion for that. And I'm hoping, you know, we can do more of that, especially in parts of our country that can really use it, because basketball is such a unifier. So.
Well, I'm excited for you, because I can think back to that same conversation that you referenced earlier, and you and I both kind of talking about what we hope to be able to do through the game of basketball and the impact that we hope to be able to have, and just bouncing ideas back and forth. And I'm excited for you that you've got this thing off the ground, and based on your track record, I know you're going to do great things with it. And we obviously, Jason and I, wish you the best of luck as it moves forward, and I'm sure we'll continue to keep an eye on it. All right, last topic. Let's just briefly give us a rundown of what it's been like at Lane through the period of COVID, how you've been able to adapt, what's been unique to the situation there in Chicago, in Illinois, for maybe coaches who are in other states that obviously everybody had it different. But just tell us a little bit about what the last year and a half has been like and what you anticipate this season, how it's looking at this point.
Yeah, so, you know, you try to unpack COVID and go through what your past year and a half looks like. You know, I always make the joke, and I don't know, it's probably cheesy dad jokes, but I think, you know, our family's a big Marvel Avengers family, and I can't help but keep thinking about, like, after, if you've seen any of the movies, you know, after Thanos happens and everyone kind of, you know, they disappear for those 5 years. Like in one of the Spider-Man movies, everyone kind of reappears and everyone's trying to, like, figure out what normalcy kind of looked like. And that's what it kind of feels like. Like, I remember last year right after so for us in Chicago Public Schools, you know, we end up getting some of our seasons very condensed, whatever, but the kids didn't have the option to come back to school until April, right? So we were virtual the entire year. And then even when we got back to school in April, it was like your class is split into Section A and Section B, and you'd only have A kids on Monday and Tuesday and B kids on Thursday and Friday. And then from that, half the class, maybe five of the 15 opted in. So you'd have five kids in your classroom and the other 25 at home virtually, or not, just taking the day off, whatever.
Right.
But I'll never forget it, man. The first day back at Lane, which is, you know this, I mean, it's my second home. I went to school there myself. I met my wife at Lane. Like, it's a very special place for me. And I remember walking down the hallway that first day back, and I heard a student say to another student, like, "Oh my gosh, is that you? You're a foot taller. Like, I didn't even recognize you." Like, like it was like we just got out of the blip. Like, we hadn't, you know, it's been like 5 years and it's like we're different people. And I don't know. Like, that was really hard for me I think that was hard for everybody. But I think, you know, we tried to have a basketball season. We ended up getting 9 games in. Our season spanned less than a month total in terms of duration. And it was kind of like, hey, we showed up. It was over before we even kind of knew it started, type of a thing. And I'm really happy we had something for the seniors. But in all honesty, it's like I said, we had a meeting today after school for all the returners about, like, what our fall conditioning and weight training is going to look like. And I told the now sophomores that, like, guys, like, truthfully, this is your first year of high school basketball. You know, like, you didn't have a full year. You had 3.5 weeks of practice, and that was shared, you know, gym space and, like, very limited interaction. And, you know, you're really getting your hands, you know, sunk in. You know, you're really diving into really what's your first full year of high school basketball. And so there's a lot that you're going to have to learn very quickly, you know. So with all that being said, you know, one of the things about Illinois, like all indoor sports, you still have to wear a mask. So in our workouts, in our weight training, in open gyms, well, I shouldn't say workouts. We're not doing any coaching. That's the rules in Illinois. But in our open gyms and our weight training, our guys have masks on. You know, when we start our season, we start playing, our guys will be in masks. And that's hard. You know, they've all played AAU and travel. And, you know, in the private sector, they're not requiring those masks and then have to go back to that. Even with, you know, even if they're vaccinated, even with a negative test, they're still in masks. So I'm not saying I'm necessarily like rah-rah for or against it. I understand the health protocols. I understand why we're doing it. But it's hard to get guys to keep their masks on and try to play basketball and focus. And, you know, I still need to find out, does that mean they're going to work in the mandatory timeouts in between quarters like they did? Like we had a, like, it was almost like a media timeout every quarter last year because he had to give mask breaks.
Right.
So those are some of the things. I mean, we've been dealing with a lot. You know, on the AD side, we're trying to plan like a pep rally and a homecoming dance. And it's like, what the heck is that going to look like? You know what I mean? So there's just a lot of things. But on the basketball side of it, man, I'm so excited. I'm so excited for a full year, excited to kind of get back to that flow and the grind of a season and scouting and playing the level of competition we're going to play and trying to get prepared for that. And whatever, man, mask, no masks. You can make us wear parkas and snow boots. Like as long as we're hooping, like I'm ready to go, man. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I think anybody who had a season like the one that you experienced, so we were a little bit different here in Ohio. It was still hit or miss in terms of scheduling because teams would be quarantined and this, and it was kind of like you'd call once a week. All right, who's available to play, and okay, we'll play you on Friday night. And certainly the schedule was a lot more fluid, but we did, most teams here were able to get in their full 22 game schedule, which was great for the kids here in Ohio. You had to wear masks on the bench, but they didn't have to wear them while they were playing. And I would anticipate that that's probably going to be the way that it goes this year. It seems like, and maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like there's not a tremendous amount of will or desire to go back to remote schooling. I think they're going to keep everybody. I mean, we have a lot of cases in our local high school here where my kids go right now, and it doesn't seem like there's much momentum to send everybody home, which I think is the right decision. I think kids need to be in school, but at the same time, it's definitely a challenge. I mean, there's a lot of kids that are quarantining and there's a lot of cases, and obviously health is the most important thing. And yet you can make a really, really good argument, as many people did through the last 18 months, that the mental health of our students is probably as important and was probably as negatively affected by being home and being isolated. And not every kid has the kind of home situation that you or I would probably dream of for them. And so that makes it even more of a challenge. So going forward, fingers are crossed that you guys get a normal season, or at least as normal as we can be in these crazy times. And hopefully we'll get the same here in Ohio, and we'll just keep plugging away, and one day we'll have this to look back on, and hopefully, just like your story about, hey man, you grew a foot since I last saw you. hopefully we'll have some more stories like that to be able to be able to remember. I know I have some that stand out for me of things that students said to me, and just having an opportunity to sit in the stands and watch my son play basketball and watch my daughters do their thing. So it's been challenging, and yet at the same time, I think that going forward, we're gonna get through it. And I don't know when, but we're gonna get through it, and hopefully we'll come out the other side stronger. And
100%.
Nick, I can't thank you enough for taking the time tonight to chat with us. Again, I look at where we were when you were on the first time, where it's an hour and a half conversation between two people who had never met, didn't know each other. And now to be able to develop a genuine friendship from hours away and be able to see one another in person at Snow Valley twice now, and just the connection that we built, It's special. It means a lot to me. Hopefully it comes through on the podcast. And again, I can't thank you enough for being a part of it. Just share one more time how people can reach out to you, connect with you, email, social media, which I know you got your Twitter locked, but hey, they can still follow you at least.
Yeah, no. So Mike, yeah, to reiterate exactly, man, same thing. Thank you for the genuine friendship and just growing through the game together. I think that's what we all, that's the best part about all this is impacting lives and learning from other coaches. So thank you. And yeah, I mean, just if anyone wants to reach out, my personal email, you know, don't reach out on the school one. That's bombarded with, I'm looking at about 400 emails right now on my screen, but my personal is just my name, Nick Legalbo, N-I-C-K-L-O-G-A-L-B-O @gmail.com. My socials, because of our school and our district, I got to keep the Twitter and Instagram on private. But again, if I get a follow request and it's, I see it's a coach or a basketball enthusiast, I accept those. You know, I just can't have current students following me on social media. So I it kind of stinks because there's times I'll put a tweet out, like a basketball tweet, and I tag someone or I want the world to see it. And only my, you know, limited followers get to see it. So I'm hoping I can get that change with our district here soon. But yeah, happy to accept the follow. And then you could kind of see whatever, if any of my little nuggets or nuggets I retweet from other people make any sense, and we can, you know, go from there. So.
Awesome. Nick, again, congratulations on the gold medal winning performance from both the men's and women's team that you were a part of. I can't even imagine the thrill that that was, and you did a really good job of articulating it. So thank you for that. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.